So thank you for coming to listen to this talk about providing our clinics in the Infertility Prevention Project with information on how much their activities and way of doing business were impacting the cost to the program, and that's essentially what the whole talk is about. In 1997, we were in the process of switching from an EIA method for our chlamydia testing to an LCR method. And that LCR test was more than twice the cost of the EIA. So we couldn't afford to continue to test the number of specimens that we had been up until that point. And so we needed to try to find some way to trim our costs without negatively impacting the work that we do by trying to find the most number of chlamydia cases by screening the fewest people. We attempt to do that by looking regularly at the selective screening criteria that we employ and seeing how well they identify disease. And so we do that as one process, but in order to specifically address this question of how can we reduce our costs without finding many fewer cases of disease, we looked at how well clinics were adhering to the selective screening criteria and found that about 15% of the specimens processed in 1997 from selective screening sites that do not include STD clinics and our reproductive health clinics, which are integrated STD and family planning clinics. But about 15% of specimens were from women who did not meet the selective screening criteria. So once we knew that information, we went through an arduous process at the state public health lab to figure out what the cost per test was, and I don't care to relive that again in the near future. but once we had those two pieces of information, we put those together and got those out to the clinics to let them know, again, what their behavior was, how their behavior was impacting program costs. And then it took us a couple years to get all the pieces in place to actually be able to start billing the clinics, but we eventually were able to do that. So in 1998, we did this analysis of our 1997 data at the clinic level. In 1999, I sent a very descriptive letter to each of the clinics, providing a variety of information that's on the next slide. In 2002, we began billing the clinics that were served by our state public health lab in Seattle. And in 2004, our partner lab in Spokane began billing their clinics. So I won't go into the details of determining cost per test at the lab. You can figure that out. Our IPP lab slip is pretty extensive. We collect not only age and demographic information, but clinical findings and behavioral information. So that's everything that we need to know whether or not a person being tested meets the selective screening criteria. All of our all of the records from each person tested are shipped to Waco, Texas, and entered into our Region 10 data system, and then those are pulled and manipulated by either Dr. Fine, who is my co-author on this paper, or the state epidemiologist for the four states in Region 10. So we calculated the number of women tested in total and the number who didn't meet the selective screening criteria for each clinic. And then we put that into a lovely, very nice, friendly letter that was mailed to the clinics. And it included, you know, why we use selective screening criteria, what they are, why we wanted to make this change, because the LCR method was so much better at identifying cases of disease than the EIA method. The fact that we wouldn't be able to continue, that we wouldn't be able to use LCR on the whole population that we had been testing previously. Their specific information on the number and percentage of all the tests in their clinic were from women who didn't meet the selective screening criteria, and the concept that they might be billed for those tests in the future. To help them change their way of doing business, we included a copy of the selective screening criteria and this little half-sheet poster that people could put in their clinics that said, you know, like the tobacco one, if you're under this age. Well, it says if you're over this age, you know, if you were born after this date in such and such a year, you're eligible for screening, which we still send out. They love that thing. What we found was that very quickly our percentage of tests that didn't meet the selective screening criteria dropped from 15% to 5%. In fact, it dropped in a year's time from 15% to 7% just by sending out that letter. And then once we started billing, we shaved it down to 5% and remains at 5% to this day. And that's all you have on that slide. So our total number of tests has fluctuated mostly because of funding streams that are outside the IPP that impact our clinic's ability to provide services. And the blue bars show those women who are under age 25. That's actually my typo up on the top there. Those are women under age 25. That's our age criterion of the selective screening criteria. The purple portion of the bar are those women over age 24 who meet the other clinical and behavioral selective screening criteria. And then the white portion of the bar are those who don't meet the selective screening criteria at all. And you can maybe observe that in 2003, we narrowed our selective screening criteria. And so you can see the change in the proportion of tests who were from women who are over 24 but continued to meet the selective screening criteria. So as I was preparing the abstract for this talk, I was kind of surprised really to see that it wasn't so much the billing itself that had caused the clinics to change their behavior, but really sharing with them just the information on who they were testing and what that was costing the program. By setting up the infrastructure for billing, we were able to address a problem that occurred in 2004 where we actually received more tests than we had funding to process. And so we billed the clinics for any tests above a certain volume. That had some potential impacts that include maybe reducing our screening coverage among young women because clinics got a little bit gun-shy of testing a lot of people for fear that they were going to be billed for those tests. Although I'm not sure that that is what happened, but it's a possibility. But on the upside, no clinics did drop out of the IPP because we started billing them. So it's been really well accepted by the clinics. And that's pretty much what I have to say. I'd like to thank Christy Warner in my office who compiled the billing information for me. I didn't share with you that we actually get reimbursed for about half of those tests. It's only about 2,000 tests a year now that don't meet the selective screening criteria. So we're feeling pretty good about, you know, not getting every single one of those tests recuperated. And I'd like to thank the Region 10 Infertility Prevention Project Advisory Committee, our public health labs in Washington State, and all the clinics. Thank you. Yes. We weren't really worried about that. Certainly they could have done that, but because we didn't start billing right away, they weren't going to be penalized for that. You know, there wasn't really incentive to do that in the beginning, and that's when the biggest change occurred. So
much less expensive,
You mean, like, have we done chart reviews to see if people... Yes. Yes. Okay, go ahead. So the question was, did it seem like there was a shift in what people reported in anticipation? Yes. Well, sure. I mean, I would assume that they were impressed by the potential. I mean, the letters went out saying, you know, your clinic is potentially going to be billed $5,000 for this cost. So, I think that had an impact on them. So. Okay, thank you very much.